House Committee on Judiciary coming over. Today is Monday, April 15th. We're going to jump right to the first bill on the agenda today because we have some people here. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2384. It will not be, we will not be able to move that today, but we will have the testimony. Representative Thatcher and Representative Barnhart, are you still here?
Yes. And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2384 would allow seizure of a motor vehicle where a person is being cited or arrested for violation, driving while suspended, misdemeanor or felony DWS, or aggravated driving while suspended, and has been cited or arrested for one of the same in the preceding 3 years. And there are amendments on this. There's dash 5 and dash 6 amendments.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Thatcher, please. Or Patty, or do you want to go?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. State Representative Phil Barnhart, House District 11. It is correct that there are dash 5 and dash 6 amendments pending. I didn't hear the committee administrator talk about any others. If there aren't any others, I'll confine my comments to these two.
Oh, there is also a dash 4 amendment, thank you, Representative, that deals with the rental car companies.
Thank you. I would note that the difference between the dash 5 and the dash 6 is one line. On the dash 5 indicates on line 12 of page 1, driving while suspended or revoked. That line is missing on dash 6, and that's the only, as far as I know, the only difference between those two amendments. I'm hoping that the committee can pass one of those, get it to the, across the House floor and over to the Senate for additional work. I continue to be opposed to the dash 4 amendments. The district attorney from Crook County is here to talk about that, if the committee is able to listen to her talk about that issue. Thank you.
And just to what the dash 5 and 6 do, the changes from the original bill, it maintains the original intent of the bill. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't identify myself. I'm Representative Kim Thatcher from House District 25. Thank you. And anyhow, the driving while suspended bill is the dash 6, like you said, will remove some of the administrative suspensions out of the, well, remove all of them, actually. Both amendments give the agencies to utilize either a criminal forfeiture or civil forfeiture, depending on, you know, which agency wants to go after. And it's still permissive. They do not have to. Both amendments require law enforcement agencies to adopt a policy and procedures on how to adopt and implement, or how they, as that jurisdiction, wants to implement the new law. So hopefully they can be, officers will make good decisions out in the field before the seizure vehicles. And just reiterating, this is optional for the jurisdiction. It is not mandatory. And that, other than just one bit of language that says at the beginning of the bill, clarifying that a motor vehicle may be seized for forfeiture rather than saying and forfeit, leading people to believe that it's going to be towed and forfeited right there. So we changed that language in both those amendments.
Please. Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Dinah Vidalins. I am the Crook County District Attorney and here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I wanted to quickly mention that as the dash 5 and dash 6 amendments are written, in order to seize and forfeit a vehicle and take that interest away, say, from Hertz Rent-A-Car, the forfeiting agency would have to prove that there was a prior conviction and that Hertz then knowingly rented that vehicle to the individual, knowing that they had that prior conviction and were driving while suspended. If we do not prevail in the claim, attorney fees are assessed against the government. We can never get attorney fees against unsuccessful claimants, but Hertz Rental Car, if we lost, would get attorney fees paid back. And so I think last week when Mr. Gardner talked about the cost is heavy, that is a real prohibition against filing frivolous lawsuits. The other issue is that this the dash 4 amendments would give rental car companies an ability to essentially engage in criminal conduct. You could, if that change was made to the forfeiture statute, a criminal car rental company could start up, and all they do is rent cars to drug dealers to make drug transactions, and there's nothing that we could do about that. They could willy-nilly do that, and there would be no protection and no ability to seize and forfeit those vehicles.
Okay, questions? Representative here.
I think you began by saying how the dash fives and sixes apply to the rental car situation. Could you just restate that?
Yes. So if in order to seize and forfeit a vehicle, there needs to be a prior criminal conviction for driving while suspended and a new criminal conviction for driving while suspended. The dash six are more narrow than the dash five, and the District Attorney's Association are happy with either set of amendments, knowing that the dash six might be a good way to start in terms of test driving this new law. So essentially what would happen is if we wanted to seize and forfeit a car from Hertz Rental Car, we would have to prove by preponderance of the evidence, and the burden is entirely on the government, that Hertz rented the car to the individual knowing that their driver's license was suspended and that they had that prior conviction, and then went ahead and rented the car anyway. So there'd be no possibility of seizing and forfeiting a car if Hertz rented the car, say, to me, and I have a valid driver's license and I let my husband drive and he has a prior conviction for criminal driving while suspended. We could not seize and forfeit that car, and as I said, the burden is entirely on the government. If we lose, we pay attorney fees and costs.
And in the dash six, what language is it that says that you have to prove that Hertz knew about the condition?
That is the forfeiture statute, which is ORS 131A at SEC.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair,
yes,
if I may. The point is, of course, that the forfeiture statute is a complete piece. We're attaching an additional item to it that this bill does. But the forfeiture statute has already completely dealt with the issue that the rental car companies seem to think has been reopened. It has not been reopened. It continues. The rule continues to be as the district attorney has indicated. And the reality, of course, is that public agencies don't have the funds to make mistakes like that. They're not going to spend time trying to forfeit cars that belong to rental agencies. It just isn't going to happen.
Thank you.
Thank you, panel. Appreciate the testimony. Jim Gardner, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm not going to repeat the testimony that I delivered last time. I do have the dash fours. I would commend them to your attention.
Could you identify yourself?
Jim Gardner, representing Hertz. Those old-timers on the committee, and I believe it was during the tenure of when Representative Krieger was chairing the committee, will recall an incident where the city of Portland, in fact, was seizing and detaining our cars when a driver was involved in a DUI and refusing to release them until and unless we paid a fee in $1,000 upwards that had some Orwellian name attached to it, like community participation fee or something like that. We want to avoid litigating a forfeiture case because, as the district attorney probably does not realize, you not only expend legal fees up front doing that, but you also lose the rental use of the car for that period, which can be an extended period of time. The provision that we are seeking is analogous to the protection that is afforded financial institutions in the Constitution, and that is that if a financial institution can demonstrate ownership of an interest that would otherwise be subject to forfeiture, there is no forfeiture proceeding. That is it in terms of their required showing. That's what we're asking for. Parity with financial institutions. And the idea, this fanciful notion of a criminal rental car company is an act of fiction. I mean, that I don't think that's ever existed, and there's no likelihood it would. It's simply a figment of someone's imagination. We would commend the dash fours to your attention.
So what I heard the opposition saying was that, so if we pass this law, then somebody could rent a car knowing that it's going to be used by drug dealers and it couldn't be forfeited later. I don't know. I'm not, as you know, not an attorney, so.
Mr. Chair, under this, and in a situation like that, I think you could get a conviction or a direct action against the rental agency. So that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about where an individual other than the owner essentially is guilty of the crime.
Jim, I find it hard to believe that any reputable company, and you're not in business anymore if you're not reputable, is going to get into the actual business of renting intentionally to drug dealers. I mean, that's pretty far out.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, I think it's fanciful. That would be the term I would use.
Okay. Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Gardner.
Thank you.
We don't have the paperwork ready today, so we're going to go ahead and close the hearing on today, and we'll figure this out, bring it back for work.
You're going to carry this to the 18th?
We will carry it to the 18th. Close the public hearing. Representative Esquivel, please, on House Bill 3434.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Sal Esquivel, Representative District 6, Medford. You have in front of you, actually, it's a solidification and a definition within the existing law that we currently have. And I hope I can explain this, but what's going on with, and you see that methadone clinics are part of this 1,000-foot, and we have a methadone clinic in Southern Oregon that changed a little bit on the way we measure. Instead of going on a straight line, they went out and then back. The state of Oregon didn't catch it, or when I called them to wonder why we licensed such a thing, the state of Oregon stated that the law wasn't specific enough. So that's what this is in front of you. There's been no change to the law other than to call 1,000-foot on a straight line basis. We ended up with this clinic within less than 800 feet from a school, and that is definitely prohibited by the state of Oregon. And yet our state said they would continue on the license because it wasn't specific enough in the law, so that's why I wrote had this drafted as it is.
Okay, any questions for Representative Esquivel? Thank you, Representative. We need some paperwork to catch up on this one as well. So
thank you, Mr. Chair.
House Bill 3434, and roll it to the 18th as well. We're going to go out of order again to accommodate some witnesses. We're going to open a hearing on a work session on House Bill 3422. Chris Gibson, please.
Chairman Barker and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today to testify in support of House Bill 3422, which establishes the crimes of drug-induced homicide and drug-induced assault. My name is Chris Gibson. I'm appearing before you today in my capacity as Vice President of the Oregon Narcotics Enforcement Association, also known as ONEA. I begin by telling you that the ONEA board supports the passage of House Bill 3422. According to information received from the Oregon Medical Examiner's Office and reported in the Oregon High Intensity Drug Trafficking Area Program's annual threat assessments and many other documents, methamphetamine and heroin-related deaths in Oregon have risen steadily since 2001. Between 2010 and 2011, overall drug-related fatalities rose 20%, many of which were the result of overdose. Deaths related to heroin use reflected the highest number of fatalities, increasing 59% from 90 to a total of 143. The second highest number of deaths was related to methamphetamine, which totaled 107 in 2011. Unlawfully obtained and used prescription medications were likely responsible for countless other deaths that have not yet been reported. In every case, there was an individual organization that was responsible for supplying the drugs that caused the deaths of each of those Oregon residents. House Bill 3422 provides clearly defined penalties that would hold those individuals and drug trafficking organizations accountable for those unnecessary deaths. House Bill 3422 also provides a useful tool for law enforcement officers in the state of Oregon called to the scene of those deaths and who are responsible for investigating the cause. Law enforcement officers in Oregon have recently come to rely upon a federal statute when investigating these cases. 21 U.S.C. 841, which imposes a minimum mandatory penalty of 20 years imprisonment, maximum life and a $10 million fine if the use of those controlled substances delivered results in the death or serious injury of another person. The threat of those enhanced penalties has proven to be a successful tool when obtaining information on sources of the supplies of those drugs by drug traffickers. Local law enforcement task forces have been relying on the federal, what's known as the Len Bias sentencing enhancement provision, during overdose investigations with a lot of success. They have found that sources are much more willing to provide information when a substantial minimum mandatory sentence is hanging over their heads. As a result, a number of highly active drug trafficking organizations have been identified and dismantled in very short amounts of time. While the U.S. Attorney's Office has been very good about applying federal law to these cases, there is always the chance that a priority shift could occur, so it would be nice to have the ability to put the decision-making into the hands of district attorneys. That's what House Bill 3422 would effectively do. Perhaps more importantly, and through its provisions that hold drug dealers more accountable for the most disastrous effect of drug trafficking, House Bill 3422 enables the state, on behalf of the families of the victims, to bring closure to what is an unavoidable, unnecessary, and often undignified loss of human life. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? This has a subsequent referral away from me, so you're indeterminate amount. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
It does have a subsequent referral. I'm speaking with the Speaker's office.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 3422. The floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 3422 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a point of clarification or a comment perhaps. So I co-chief this bill with Representative Widener. It will seem similar to the middle component in House Bill 2204. That's the one that also involved oxys and then mm-hmm. effectively paid for it by adjusting the marijuana penalties. So anyway, I just wanted that noted that we're not crazy. They are, in fact, kind of repeat. I think between the two, despite the fact that my name's on the one, I think the 2204 approach is pretty elegant, but I leave that up to the good people, Ways and Means.
Okay. Is there any further discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So this already has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means?
Yes.
Just don't work. Okay.
It wasn't on the sheet, but
no.
we checked it. Yeah. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. No moves. Okay.
Mr. Chair, can I just ask a question?
Yes,
there are several bills on our work session list today that it seems to me need subsequent referrals and are not listed. The ones that start with creates a crime, for example. Yeah. And I want to make sure we right. have a clear yeah. understanding of which ones are going to Ways and Means and which ones aren't.
Yeah.
So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the following bills, although they don't necessarily all say subsequent referral to Ways and Means on the agenda, have been cleared by the Speaker's office for subsequent referral to Ways and Means. 2594, 2661, 2957, 2019, 2204, 2314, 2549, and 3422.
Thank you.
Open a work session of House Bill 2019. Schmidt.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2019 creates the crime of patronizing a trafficked child where a person offers or agrees to engage in a commercial sex act with a minor or with a law enforcement officer posing as a minor. The prior is punishable as a Class B felony, level 9 on crime seriousness. The latter would be a Class C felony, level 7 on crime seriousness. Makes prior convictions for prostitution count as half-person crimes when calculating criminal history score. Modifies crime of trafficking in persons by creating different felony classifications for benefiting financially from trafficking and knowing that another person will be subjected to involuntary servitude, Class B felony, and knowing that a person will be coerced into commercial sex acts by force or fraud and disregarding the fact that trafficked person is a minor, is Class A felony. Includes these crimes under the rape shield laws for evidentiary purposes, allows application by DA for use of technology to intercept wire, oral, or electronic communication in the investigation of these crimes, allows victims of these crimes to apply to the court for restitution awards and to criminal victims compensation fund for covering of certain related expenses, includes these crimes under definition of crimes covered by racketeering statute, includes these crimes in definition of sex crimes, making these registrable offenses, adds these crimes to definition of sexual exploitation, declares an emergency in effect upon passage.
Thank you. Is there any discussion? And this bill has a subsequent referral as well.
Let me make sure that it has the fiscal. It's not here yet. So this bill doesn't have the fiscal yet, so we have to roll it over.
Okay, we do not have the fiscal ready today, so we're going to have to roll this one over to the 18th as well. Close the work session. Open the work session on House Bill 2204.
This is the same situation. We don't have but there's a new amendment. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2204 is the bill that Representative Barton was just referring to that has a Len bias component to it. Also talks about oxycodone, and it breaks out crime classifications per pill. That amendment has been submitted to LFO. We're waiting on the fiscal to come back on that. The dash one amendment is ready to go, but the fiscal is not, so we can't move it today.
Okay. We'll close the work session, House Bill 2204. I'm going to jump back up to schedule and open a public hearing on House Bill.
Mr. Chair, before you did that, we are carrying this over until Wednesday.
Until the 18th.
Okay, thank you.
And committee, I've asked to have a meeting room scheduled for Thursday, the 18th evening, in case we're not able to wrap up during our day session. Hopefully we'll be able to zip through. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2661 and call Representative Frederick, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2661 requires the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission to study and report on racial, ethnic, economic disparities in citizen interaction with police officers and on recruitment and retention of law enforcement-related institutions.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I'm Representative Lou Frederick, representing House District 43 in North and Northeast Portland, and I'm back again to talk about House Bill 2661, the Dash 1 Amendment, relating to police officer interactions with the public. This amendment substantially narrows the focus of the bill. This is based on methodology available in agencies equipped to conduct the study. It removes references to recruitment and retention of minorities in the criminal justice system and references to interaction between law enforcement and the community not related to crime, because we don't have anybody currently with the capacity or methodology to study those things, quite frankly. We may be able to get a lot of that later on. We do have the expertise and the capacity in the Criminal Justice Commission and the PSU Criminal Justice Policy Research Institute to study disparities in race and ethnicity of persons stopped, arrested, and subjected to use of force. That would be the focus of the bill with the amendment. Now, I talked with you before about why this subject needs to be studied and tracked. Practices that target certain groups differently from others are the kinds of things that flourish in the dark. The first step towards equal treatment is to get it out in the open with data and not just anecdotes. We have plenty of those, and that's what this is about.
representatives are here from the agencies that would do the work called for by the amended bill. It is, it does have a small fiscal. I would argue that this is a very small price considering how important it is to some sizable constituencies in the state. And I guess I'll probably have to make that argument to Ways and Means as well, and I have already started that. I hope you'll adopt the Dash 1 amendment and pass HB 2661 along to Ways and Means.
Representative, is it not the case that we're already doing these studies now and just the funding stream has changed?
That's right, exactly. We started actually doing these studies several years ago, and they were being done on a sample basis. Different cities would do it and not continue it necessarily for a while. Those cities found that they were in fact getting a great deal of good information about how certain communities were being addressed, certain people were being dealt with, and they would like to continue to have that kind of information. And I think we can do better the rest of the state as well if we're able to continue to track this.
Thank you. Is there any questions? Thank you, Representative. And I don't have anybody else signed up to testify today.
Maybe not. Okay. I thought we had somebody here, but no, maybe not. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Take care.
We have the Dash 1 amendments.
2661. Yeah. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 2661.
Representative Krieger moves the Dash 1 amendments in House Bill 2661. Is there any discussion? Is there any objections? Hearing done, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 2661 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 2661 as amended to the floor with a due pass, subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing done, so ordered. Okay. We'll go back to the work session, open a work session on House Bill 2314.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2314 amends intimidation in the first degree to apply to actions of a person acting alone where physical injury is inflicted, where physical injury is negligently inflicted with a dangerous weapon, or where a person is placed in imminent fear of serious physical injury. It modifies intimidation in the second degree to add conforming language. It modifies ORS 135703 to not allow civil compromise of crimes of intimidation. Changes ORS 137225. To exempt conviction for intimidation in first and second degree from being set aside. There are two amendments on this before the committee that you should have. They are the Dash 1 and the Dash 3 amendments. And the Dash 1 amendments adds in color and ethnicity into the covered places or into the covered characteristics. The Dash 3 amendments I believe address the civil compromise aspect of this
to allow
civil compromises,
and also remove the expungement part.
So it makes the crime eligible for expungement.
Okay.
So this will allow civil compromise.
It will.
Yes.
Yeah,
thank you. So I don't know, Mr. Chair. I do have John Harrelson, the district attorney from Benton County, here. If you want to hear.
I think we're ready to go on.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 2314.
President Krieger moves the Dash 1s into House Bill 2314. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the Dash 3 amendments into House Bill 2314.
Representative Krieger moves the Dash 3 amendments into House Bill 2314. Is there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 2314 as amended to the floor, due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 2314 to the floor with a due pass, subsequent referral to as amended, a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. And Mr. Representative Olson, I appreciate witnesses coming, but we have a huge schedule we're trying to get through. And by the 18th, we have to be done, so we're really pushing ahead here. Is there any discussion on the motion? Is there any objections to the motion? Seeing none, so ordered. Open a work session on House Bill 2334.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2334 clarifies the mental state promoting prostitution is knowingly in ORS 167012 and adds attempt into covered conduct. There are amendments on this. There's a dash 2 and a dash 3 amendment for the committee. The dash 2 amendment clarifies that the attempted language would apply to the person who is being forced into prostitution, so that if you were the person who was promoting or compelling, you could still be convicted of an attempt, but it wouldn't be written into the language. It'd be like it normally is with other crimes. The dash 3 amendment makes a gives a defense to the charge if you are yourself under the age of 18 and you are being influenced by another person to get someone else into prostitution. So essentially, if a someone who is promoting or compelling convinced a 17-year-old to get their friend into the business, that would be a defense.
Okay. Representative Krieger, you.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This was a bill that I was chief sponsor on, and I support the dash 2 amendment, but not the dash 3. We heard from, do you want me to talk about
yes,
that?
Yes, please.
Okay, we heard from the DAs and from the public safety. They didn't support the dash 3 amendment because what happens is these young kids who are promoting other kids to commit the crime of prostitution, that they would not pick up the compelling underage child. And so she would still be on the, she or he would still be on the street. Right. Because it would be an affirmative defense, the police officers would not pick that child up. And so they would prefer to pick her up and keep her off the streets.
So just the best.
Okay, thank you, Representative, for the dash 2. On the other side of that.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the dash 2 amendments to the House Bill 2334.
Representative Krieger moves the dash 2 amendments into House Bill 2334. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, where did the dash 3s come from?
We think from the Safety and Justice.
Juvenile rights.
Juvenile rights. Okay. Right. And Moore is not here.
She's not. Okay, we have a motion before us to move the dash 2 amendments in House Bill 2334. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2334 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 2334 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Just a question, Mr.
Yes.
Chair. Other bills here that modify crimes are going to Ways and Means. Was there a discussion about why this is not?
How's that not?
Was there any discussion of fiscal possible fiscal impact?
I haven't heard that there was. It says on the fiscal that it has a minimal fiscal impact.
We went through the speaker's office today to be sure which ones they wanted. I mean, that's why you have to do that.
So okay.
The dash 2 is indeterminate.
Just wanted to ask the question. Thank you.
No, good question. Is there any objections to the bill moving forward? Seeing that's ordered, Representative Tomei, would you prepare it, please?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. 3362 is not ready to go today, so we'll have to carry that over until the 18th.
Which bill?
3662.
Please move it to the floor.
Okay. Also, 2431 creates the offense of prostitution for a person under 18 years of age is not ready and has to be moved to the 18th. 2549 directs the Department of Corrections to establish risk assessment tool applicable to sex offenders is not ready, and we're going to carry that over to the 18th as well. Open a work session on House Bill 2595. Oh, I'm sorry. We're going to roll that. Two more bills that we just were informed to roll over. So I'm closing the work session. I'm rolling over House Bill 2595 and 2596.
Until the 18th?
We'll say to the 18th. If we can get them sooner, we'll get them back.
Remind me to be gone on the 18th.
Yeah. We'll roll that one over till tomorrow, just in case we can. Okay, open a work session on.
I don't even know what's happening.
Tomorrow, yeah.
Bill 3237. Work
session.
3327? 3327.
Sorry. That's a mouse pocket. Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3327 authorizes court to set aside conviction of sex crime listed in ORS 181830 if a person has been relieved of obligation to register as a sex offender and they have not been convicted of an otherwise non-eligible crime. Authorizes juvenile court to expunge records of person who were found to be in jurisdiction of juvenile court based on act if committed by adult would have constituted rape 3, sodomy 3, sex abuse 3, or an attempt to commit any of those crimes if certain requirements are met. And there is a dash 2 amendment before the committee.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'll call Will Lathrop up.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, my name is Will Lathrop, and I'm here on behalf of ODAA. I work down the street at Marion County District Attorney's Office, and I'll try to be brief because I know that you're letting me talk a little bit out of turn here. I have prosecuted child sex and sex abuse and child abuse for 6 years now, and my concerns in opposition to this bill and the concerns of ODAA are twofold. One is that it eliminates the ability to do deal downs. Just above sodomy 3, rape 3, and sex abuse 3 are sex abuse 1, rape 2, sodomy 2, which are all, as you know, about Measure 11 crimes. It's very often when a juvenile enters the system on their very first touch with the law in this area that significant negotiations will occur and a prosecutor will deal down to lesser included offenses in order for these juveniles to get a second chance without having to do significant time in OIA and maybe even adult prison. And I think that a prosecutor knowing that an offender can expunge something in 5 years is going to affect deal downs. It's going to have an unintended impact in this against defendants that hasn't been possibly discussed. Maybe it has. Apologize if it has. The other problem is it's a little bit too short. And even if you're not dealing with deal downs or you're just dealing with straight up criminal activity or convictions or adjudications that deal with just rape 3, sodomy 3, and sex abuse 3, 5 years in the sex world is not a very long time, and the reason why is because of late disclosures, as probably a lot of you already know. It's very rare that you get disclosures of 1 day, 2 days, or a month. Most of the victims that come forward are years, if not 6 or 8 years. And so allowing even a juvenile defendant who's been adjudicated for a sex crime to expunge something in such a short amount of time allows that person... I guess the short point is that a lot of other crime could occur before you would even find out about it because their next victims could be disclosing 6, 8, 10 years down the line. And by the time those victims disclose, the prior victim will be completely expunged and will have no idea that even occurred and will be treated like a first-time offender. And I don't know that's in intent or what the committee's looking for. And I have a specific example of where that would have occurred if you want to hear it, but if you're pressed for time, I won't do that.
How could we fix this bill?
I think it just needs a longer, closer to, I think what it is now is 10 years, and it probably should, in the interest of being safe, probably should stay at about 10 years, I would say.
Okay, and so this is expungement, not registration?
Yeah, it's expungement. Yeah.
Okay.
I think we'll about finish the bill today. We'll roll this one over too. So we can't.
Thank you very much.
Anybody else have any?
I have a question.
Sure.
When you talk about deal downs, how often in Marion County do juveniles are juveniles required to waive their right to a second look hearing in a deal down on one of those charges?
I think that on a deal down, this is my limited understanding of juvenile law, but I think on a deal down to somebody that's not ballot measure 11, second look hearings are pretty much, they happen all the time. But second look hearings are usually with regards to people that go into custody. And these sort of crimes for a juvenile, if it's a first-time offense, you're probably looking at probation. So I'm not sure that second look really necessarily usually applies. And I don't know if I'm answering your question, but maybe a little bit.
I think you are.
Okay.
It's my understanding, Mr. Chair, that it, often when you deal down from a Measure 11 sex crime to one that is not, that a juvenile is asked to waive their ability to have a second look hearing as part of that deal. And so I want to make sure I understand how that impacts that practice as well.
Okay. Thank you.
I think that's my understanding, not just on the sex crimes, but another, when you plead down a Measure 11, they're essentially getting a half sentence to begin with, usually. So then at that time, they say you can't get a half of a half. So I think that's correct. Okay, I'll close the work session. I'll enroll it over to the 18th on House Bill 3327. Okay. And House Bill 3467 is not ready either, so we'll roll it to the 18th. It's going to be fun on the 18th. Okay, open a work session on House Bill 2594.
Chair, I move the.
We've done a public hearing.
Yeah,
I think it's a matter of.
So modifies the standard for the.
It says first public hearing, but we heard this before, didn't we?
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, sorry, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2594, we have heard previously on February 21st. There's a -2 amendment that should be in front of the committee. So originally, as this bill was written, it modified the standard for civil commitments in order to broaden those. The -2 gets away from that concept and actually creates a tiered system where if you are not quite at the point yet where you would meet the criteria for inpatient treatment, which requires that you are in imminent danger to yourself, danger to others, or unable to care for your basic needs, then you can't be inpatient committed. This bill would say that if you are in danger of dissipating to a point where you will soon be in that imminent danger to self, others, or in danger of your basic needs, that you can be essentially ordered to do treatment in a mental health court type scenario, so that the judge would then take jurisdiction of your case and could tell you that you have to go meet with treatment providers and meet with you in the court on whatever basis the judge deems. So it would create an outpatient assisted treatment. It wouldn't be inpatient treatment anymore.
And it's my understanding that they can not force medication. Sorry.
That's right. The concept was that you would not be able to force somebody to medicate. You would not be able to use jail as a punishment, incarceration, and you would not be able to send them to the state hospital for not meeting the standards of the outpatient assisted treatment. Essentially, the only way to get somebody sent to the state hospital for inpatient commitment would be to hold another inpatient commitment hearing and follow the normal procedures. So this wouldn't change anything with the inpatient commitment procedures. This would just create another standard where if you meet this standard that is not as eminent, you could be ordered to do outpatient assisted treatment.
Okay, thank you. I'll close the public hearing, open a work session, House Bill 2594. Put the -2s. This has a subsequent referral in the end.
We don't have
the paperwork to move it today.
Okay, we'll go ahead and put the -2s in here.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the Dash 2 amendments into House Bill 2594.
Representative Krieger moves the Dash 2 amendments into House Bill 2594. Is there any discussion? Is there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. We'll have to roll that over as well. And this one is 2957. Okay. Right. Have we? Didn't we have a public hearing on that one too?
Yes.
Okay, we had a hearing.
Okay.
Oh no, I do too. Some people signed up. Call Aaron Jeffers. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2957. Call Aaron Jeffers and Becky Strauss, please.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2957 includes conduct of announcing but not displaying a deadly weapon to commit robbery in the first and second degree, or would change robbery in the second degree to robbery in the first degree with a simulated weapon. It includes use of an object that reasonably resembles a deadly weapon into robbery in the first degree. There's a Dash 1 amendment in front of the members, which would create a defense to anyone who, it would only apply this crime to people who are 18 years and older.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Becky Strauss here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to come testify. I did not testify in the first public hearing and spent some time listening to the discussion, and just wanted to take a minute with the opportunity now to make sure that there's another piece I didn't feel was kind of adequately addressed in the discussion about the purpose behind the bill. And there was a lot of discussion about the same impact on the victim, regardless of whether the weapon is real or just being displayed as a real weapon or not. And I just wanted to bring in the point about the Oregon Constitution requirement that penalties be proportionate to the crime. And I think that there is part of the policymaking consideration here is the threat to the level of harm that might happen and the difference between that threat when there is a real weapon in the commission of the crime and when there isn't. So just thank you for the opportunity to raise that point. We are opposed to the bill for that reason. We don't believe it strikes the right proportionality in terms of the difference between those two crimes and the threats. So thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Jeffers.
Aaron Jeffers for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Chair Barker, members of the committee, we share the concern of the ACLU that the statute that stands is good policy, that there is a reason to retain a distinction between robbery that occurs with a deadly weapon and robbery that occurs with a non-deadly weapon, that there's a very real reduction in the actual danger rather than the perceived danger, which is the victim's focus, that the victim is in. And the type of person also that would bring a deadly weapon into the situation is very different criminal from the one that chooses not to bring that level of dangerousness into the equation. We feel like the law should reflect that distinction. In one situation, the robber can pull a trigger and take a life, and in the other, they cannot. This bill, we also concerned, would undo one of the policy public safety changes that's being considered by the Joint Committee on Public Safety. And I did mention this in my prior testimony, but House Bill 3194 contemplates moving robbery in the second degree out of Measure 11. This bill would put a substantial number of those cases right back in. And we feel like the anecdotal evidence that we heard about the victims and the threat to the victims, although the perceived threat is real, is not enough to undo the good public policy that exists currently under 164405 and 164415. Thank you.
Okay, any questions? One of the concerns I always have about these kind of bills is if somebody that has a concealed handgun is in the place when somebody pulls off what they think is a pretend robbery, they may end up getting shot. I mean, so the lives are, I believe, are at risk during an armed robbery. If the person has his hand in his pocket, or if he has especially if they have a replica gun, which looks very real. So I have some real concerns about not doing this. We did hear from people about the juveniles. We did remove them from the bill. And while 3194 is a long way from being finished up yet, I'm not so sure Robbery 2 is coming out of that. I'm not convinced of that yet. It may happen, but I don't know. So, committee, we do have the Dash 1 amendments. to this? Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And far be it from me to stick up for armed robbers at all. So, however,
I know it's a little unique, sticking up for armed robbers.
But I think that the testimony, I think they have some legitimate points. And also, I think there's a, I think the single best argument against it is actually the fiscal impact. So essentially, this shifts. Rob 2 has a mandatory minimum, I believe, of 70 months. Rob 1 has a mandatory minimum, I believe, of 90 months. This essentially shifts the bulk of Rob 2s into Rob 1. Rob 2 is the third most common Measure 11 offense. So this is a meaningful, this is a meaningful population we're adding 20 months to. That's going to have a big fiscal. Fine, no problem. However, as long as we're doling out fiscals, I just, and as you know, I'll say this, there are a healthy number of sex offenses out there that, depending on the circumstances of presumptive probation, I would just rather spend those dollars elsewhere to the extent we're doling out on increased sentences. My opinion only, Mr. Chair.
And a huge number of the people who are being charged under robbery 2 are plea downs from robbery 1 to begin with.
No doubt about it.
Mr. Chair.
Testimony. I don't believe
we had testimony. You probably don't have any statistics on the number of people.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I don't have the specific numbers. I know it's a substantial number that I think going both ways. I don't know how many would plea downs there are from Rob 1 to Rob 2. I think if that happens, there was an anecdotal incident that was submitted with prior testimony where the robber came in with something that looked like a gun, but nobody could find the gun and they couldn't prove it. And so all they could convict the person of was a robbery in the second degree, even though I'm sure the DA wanted to try and convict that person of robbery in the first degree. But again, I think that is a factual problem. I think that is an actual legal factual problem where it's a question still of whether or not the person used an actual weapon or not. And so it's probably just in that situation that a person wasn't convicted of what is now robbery one when there wasn't evidence that he actually used a deadly weapon. So I don't know what the numbers would break down. I do know that there is a substantial number of robberies that occur without a deadly weapon that would be caught up in this and then become robbery ones.
Thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. With respect to the question about numbers and data, I know the Commission on Public Safety took a look at the robbery and the second degree crime, and I cannot break it apart between simulated weapons versus just, you know, a stapler or something. But it was a significant cost driver for the DOC budget. It was one of the principal drivers of the juvenile population into DOC as an adult. And it was also among the top 10 crimes driving the DOC forecast. So I just point out to the committee that robbery in the second degree does carry significant there are a significant number of cases that go into DOC based on that.
Mr. Chair. Just a comment more than a question. I think that it can't be underscored enough that this is a big policy shift, moving from looking at the actions of the defendant to the perception of the victim as a way to change the way we look at crime. I think that I just don't want that to be missed in this discussion, that it is a policy shift.
Okay. Any further discussion?
Can I ask her? Maybe I'll ask her a question. Could, for any member of our panel, could you please describe the current Robbery 2 escape hatch? Is anyone capable of doing that at the moment?
I can get my code.
Or anyone in the office? Or anyone in the audience?
I don't know.
What's that?
The escape
I know. You don't have to feel compelled, but
thank you. Scott Healy, Senior Deputy DA in Clackamas County, Chair, members of the committee, and I hadn't planned to actually testify on this bill.
You're between, real quick. You're here.
Okay. What bill is it? And what's the question?
2597. It has to do with whether or not somebody using a simulated deadly weapon moves up to robbery one that are now robbery two.
If you purport to have a weapon? No, that's a rob two. It can't
be. The bill changes that.
Okay, and that's what this bill changes it from purporting to have a weapon to a robbery in the first degree?
Yeah.
All right.
A simulated weapon.
Yes. Okay.
So the question was the carve out, the opt out?
Mm-hmm. Well, the opt out, and it's under RS 137717. We call it ballot measure 11 light in the business. There are usually four or five, and I can take a look at them right here and actually reiterate them on the record for you, things that have to be present in order for the court to then be able to move to have discretion to take it out of ballot measure 11. And when they take it out of ballot measure 11, then it will go back to a guidelines sentence. They can do anything they want with it at that point in terms of either, you know, they would go to the gridlock just like they normally would. And they can either depart downward or upward, depending on aggravating factors. And I'll talk about that in just a second. But currently, if based on what you're telling me, and once again, I haven't looked at the bill recently. I had a conversation about it, I think, about a month ago. Then if it's going to make it a robbery in the first degree, it won't be subject to this opt-out, because first degree, you know, robbery...
No.
Won't be subject to that opt-out.
What is the opt-out? I'm not remembering what the opt-out is.
Chair Barker, Representative Hicks, the opt-out right now states that if the conviction is for robbery in the second degree and the victim did not suffer a significant physical injury and that if the defendant represented by words or conduct that the defendant was armed with a deadly weapon, the representation did not reasonably put the victim in fear of imminent physical injury, and the defendant does not have a previous conviction for a crime listed in subsection 4.
There's also
a prior measure 11.
I'm sorry, Chair, members of the committee, there's also a subsection that talks about the defendant also represented by word or conduct the defendant was armed with a dangerous weapon, and that didn't also, because there's a difference between the two. As you know, a deadly weapon is any weapon defined anyway by law, any weapon that's really actually designed to cause you know, death or serious physical injury. A dangerous weapon is any weapon that we can use, like a baseball bat or any weapon that we can grab and then scare somebody with, basically. But
Mr. Chair? So before you get, what I'm trying to get at, the underlying question, could someone clarify, are we going from a theoretical but legal possibility of potentially probation if we go to the grid and then downward depart under mitigating circumstances up to 90 minimum months? I mean, I know that is theoretically that's what's happening, or is there any implication for that with this?
Well, robbery in the first degree and robbery in the second degree are both nines.
Yeah.
And so if the defendant had no prior criminal history, they'd be a 9I. That's 34 to 36 months on the grid block. So they'd be in a presumptive prison grid block.
Yeah.
If you go to the
downward departure, though.
I'm sorry.
If you get a weird fact pattern, a downward departure, the judge could dispositionally depart.
Go clear to probation, yeah.
Yeah. And so... So is any what I'm let me say it again. Okay, so current existing law, Rob 2, theoretically under the right fact pattern, the right defendant on the right day could get probation.
Yes.
Okay, and I mean legally. So what I'm asking is whether that same fact pattern is now sort of going up to 90 minimum months. Okay.
Yeah, I understand. Okay.
I think you're right.
Just a moment. Let me look at the bill.
Chair Barker, Representative Hicks, I agree with you.
Yeah.
I think that's what it does do.
You think
bill.
That's what it does do?
Yeah.
Aaron thinks so, too. Okay.
Yeah, I think so.
With the qualifier that you'd have to have a sentencing judge find a dispositional departure from a presumptive mm-hmm. prison down to yeah. a probationary sentence with some local jail.
I'm saying, so, Mr. Chair, if I may, I mean, there's a legal kind of way of getting there, how often it happens, but...
If I could ask a clarifying question, Mr. Healy, you said one of those factors, and I'm not super familiar with those opt-out factors, and Gail, you have them in front of you. One of the factors is that if the victim is reasonably in fear, in serious fear, could you read that one?
Thank you. Chair Barker, Mr. Schmidt, it states... These are conjunctives. If the conviction is for robbery in the second degree, the victim did not suffer a significant physical injury, and that if the defendant represented by words or conduct that the defendant was armed with a deadly weapon,
the representation did not reasonably put the victim in fear of imminent physical injury.
Okay, thank you.
And that the defendant does not have a previous conviction for Measure 11 crime.
Okay, so as I'm reading this bill and that opt-out, I don't think that your fact pattern is accurate.
Okay.
Because, so this requires that this person displays an object that a reasonable person would presume to be a deadly weapon. So your fact pattern was where a victim sees a weapon but is not frightened,
I don't know about that.
Essentially, to get the
yes,
opt-out.
That's mm-hmm. my understanding.
Right. So if this person displayed a reasonable person would presume to be a deadly weapon, the only way that you could get to this situation would be if they looked at what essentially looked like a fake gun, but then the victim wasn't scared.
Got it.
And that doesn't seem like that will happen. Mr. Healy, in
yeah,
your experience?
And Chair Barker, members of the committee, I agree with what Mr. Schmidt has just said, and now I'm also remembering kind of the purpose behind this bill. There are cases, and I've prosecuted them, it's probably been about a decade now, where individuals say, a Schuck's Auto Supply robbery that I had one time, the defendant goes in there and he's got a big Smith & Wesson. It was a revolver, and he pointed it directly at the owner. He ultimately gets out of there with all the money, and he leaves, and he goes, and we're able to identify him by ways I won't tell you, bore you with right now. But we never recovered the weapon. We never recovered the gun. And so currently, the way robbery in the first degree is written, we have to prove that that gun was a deadly or dangerous weapon. And so we therefore, you know, normally have to prove that it was readily capable of use as a weapon. It was an operable weapon. Now, it's kind of hard to do that if you don't have the gun. There is case law that says that we can do that through circumstantial evidence, sort of the testimony of the eyewitness. But if the eyewitness, you know, is really scared at the time, and once again, the reason that they wouldn't be able to opt out, they oftentimes, where they're not familiar with guns, they're not able to help us. You know, we're absolutely certain, you know, that it was a real gun, and they're able to say that they believe that it was a real gun, but, you know, we can't actually prove it because we don't have the actual weapon. So we have difficulty proving those as robbery in the first degree crime sometimes under that fact pattern. I was successful in that case because the guy was ex-military and he was able to very much describe the weapon. He actually saw the bullets in the revolver. But if it's an automatic weapon, you know, they're not able to see whether or not there's bullets or not. So that is, I think, the reason, the purpose behind this bill is that, you know, if someone goes in there with a real gun and points it at the victim and they are, you know, scared, but they get away and we're not able to, you know, recover the weapon, but we have a good case otherwise, we're still able to charge them with robbery in the first degree. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was the one that brought the bill forward at a request of a constituent who was in a bank, was a bank teller here in the community that was involved in one of a series of robberies where a gentleman used a fake gun that looked real to her when it occurred. And that's what the bill was all about. So literally, the gun was found. And it wasn't real, but it looked real at the time. And I just did a ride-along with the sheriff on Friday night and serving some warrants and some other things we did. If somebody would have pulled a gun between me and you right now that looked real, I wouldn't want to be standing next to the sheriff when that happened.
If I could address the earlier question about whether or not the situation would remove the possibility that somebody could get out of probation, I think that we should look a little longer at that to get the answer, because under 137.712, the exceptions to 137.700, I'm looking at the language where it says in section B and C, Section D, B, and DC did not reasonably put the victim in fear of imminent significant physical injury and did not reasonably put the victim in fear of imminent physical injury. I think those are separate requirements, the fear that aren't required by the statute itself. And so I'm not sure that it doesn't remove that situation where it would otherwise be available. So we could look further at that. But
Chair Barker, maybe this is a question for Mr. Schmidt. Or When it says displays an object that a person would presume to be a deadly weapon, what we didn't know is, does that preclude the finger in the pocket?
Don't point that. It's got a nail.
Yeah.
It's got a nail in it.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Meyer, that's the understanding that we get from legislative counsel, that would not, the finger in the pocket would not be covered by this.
So displays an object means the object needs to be
to see the object
in view.
Thank you.
Okay, no further questions. And deadly weapon, does that include like a gun that is clearly unloaded? Like a broken down single-shot shotgun?
There is a statutory definition of deadly weapon that I believe says something to the effect that it is an object that has been manufactured for the purpose of being deadly. So
a deadly weapon would still be a deadly weapon under the language here without actually being loaded, and even without the victim knowing that it's loaded. The victim knowing it's unloaded. Okay. I'm sorry. Okay, well.
Chair Barker, I think it specifically says that it's specifically designed to cause death or serious physical injury, like a gun or a knife or a samurai sword or something like that.
Interesting. Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
There's another one for the 18th, huh? We'll close the hearing on House Bill, if you're sure I say the right one here, 2957. Okay. Any further business? Adjourn.
See you Thursday night.
Yeah. Late Thursday.
Be here late.